Sheffield Live, made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what, I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X-T.
Good morning, welcome to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. Talking about science in all its different forms, you can listen online at sheffieldlive.org. You can also go there for the podcasts and download them, listen to them later. They generally pop up 30 minutes after each hour. You've got Julian Paul here live as usual this Saturday the 28th of September 2024. That's just in case you're listening in on catch up. Later in the show, we'll be talking to RPG. We've got no guest speaker this week. Our Chris couldn't be with us, but he'll be with us next month. And all being well, next week, and indeed every first Saturday of the month, our guest speaker will be Phil Muffett from the Mexburn Swinton Astronomical Society. Talking of which, I spotted on social media that they're doing an astronomy night at the Camellia House, Wentworth Woodhouse, Saturday the 12th of October. It starts at 7 p.m. and goes on to around 9:30. I think this is the second one they'll be doing. I think the one got cancelled because of the weather. So well, let's see what happens, and maybe he'll tell us a bit more about that next week. So first up, we're going to talk about something. I saw this article quite a while back, but I thought, I think it's an interesting one. Particularly as last week RPG was talking about the great butterfly count and the fact that it's been an abysmal year for butterflies to do with the weather, amongst other things, but to do with the habitat loss and pesticides. And in fact, last night on Gardener's World, if you watched it, they did cover it and giving tips on how to be more eco-friendly and ensure the ecosystem in your own garden is as good as it can be. So I thought it's timely to do this then about the article's called Meet the Slug Eaters. So it says slugs may be perceived as the gardener's enemy, but they are very important players in garden ecosystems. We may struggle to love their slimy faces, but their vital role, particularly as detritivores, which means they break down rotting material and recycle nutrients into the soil, it's an invaluable role they play. They also provide a food source for other garden wildlife. So this article goes on to talk about what are the five key slug munchers. So the first one, it talks about beetles and other invertebrates. So ground beetles are efficient predators, roaming grassland and woodland to hunt their prey with grasping jaws. Many other invertebrates also hunt slugs, including rove beetles, centipedes, and nematoids. Oh, some of these I can't even pronounce, but soil-dwelling parasites. The other one, it talks about a carnivore slugs, so the shelled slugs are devoted carnivores, feeding on earthworms, slugs, and other creatures smaller than themselves. Very interesting. One we might know more about is hedgehogs, although they're quite rare to see in your back garden these days. Hedgehogs are often recommended as slug eaters, but slugs usually form only 10% of a hedgehog's diet. Hedgehogs tend to prefer worms, beetles, and caterpillars, but in the autumn, and we're in autumn now, slugs become an important source of calories for the hedgehogs before they go into hibernation. So the other slug eaters are amphibians and reptiles. Now, frogs and toads enjoy a slimy meal. Slugs form about a quarter of the common frog's diet. So gardens with ponds or habitat for frogs and toads to overwinter are likely to have slug numbers kept in check. Slow worms will also hunt slugs, another good reason to build a hibernation station. And the theme is here, we shouldn't be killing slugs or using slug pellets. They're a really important part of that ecosystem. And finally, we're talking about birds. Some birds may find the sticky slime off-putting, but many birds will devour slugs. And that includes robins, starlings, crows, blackbirds and ducks. Blackbirds in particular can often be seen wiping the excess slime off on grass before swallowing a slug. So who knew? Great piece of music. We play that quite often when we're talking about things in the garden. That was The Garden by Bill Nelson, 1982. Beautiful piece of music. We play that because we're talking about slugs. Be kind to them. They're part of the ecosystem. Don't poison them. They feed a lot of things in your garden. So if you're just tuned in, you're listening to Life Science Radio Show, of course, here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM. On digitally in South Yorkshire or SheffieldLive.org, talking about science in all its different forms. As I said, we should have had Chris Dale on. He's been talking about for quite a long time now, about a year, I think, about ultra-processed food and people's diets and things like that. So I thought I'd just cover, he can't be with us today, but I just thought I'd cover a few things that he probably would be very interested in himself. Now, this information has come from the European Food Information Council. That's EUFIC.org, and it's this article I picked up was all about hidden emulsifiers. What are emulsifiers? My word. So the food additives that are used to help mix two substances that typically separate when they are combined. They play an important role in the manufacture of food products, enhancing their appearance, taste, texture and shelf life. All sounds very familiar, doesn't it? So emulsifiers used in food production are either purified natural products derived from plants or animals, or synthetic chemicals that have similar structures to natural products. For example, lecithin. If you look at any chocolate bar, and I have, you'll find it's widely used in all chocolate products. Lecithin is also known as E322. Wildly used in chocolate products, can be sourced from soya beans, eggs, liver, peanuts and wheat germ. Another one is pectin, which is E440, can also be found naturally in fruits such as apples and pears. Now, there's about 60 additives in the category emulsifiers. Stabilizers, gelling agents and thickeners are permitted in food. And below are some of their uses. As I said, a lot of them can come from natural sources, but often they're not coming from natural sources. They're coming from, they've been synthesized, and it's just not good news. So where would you find these hidden emulsifiers? Well, bread. Now, it's possible to make bread without emulsifiers, but the result is often dry, low in volume, and goes stale easily. There are two types of emulsifiers used in bread. Dough strengtheners, such as some of these I cannot pronounce even. The emulsifiers used in bread, dough strengtheners such as diacetyl tartaric acid esters, or E472E, and sodium or calcium stearoyl, -2-lactylate, which is also known as E481 and E482. The others are dough softeners, such as mono and diglycerides of fatty acids, which are E471. Now, dough strengthening agents result in bread with an improved texture and volume, and dough softening agents allow increased shelf life. Important thing here is you're not going to find any of these chemicals if you make your own bread. But as you know, if you make your own bread, it's going to go stale rather easily. So this is where all these emulsifiers come in. The other one, chocolate. All chocolate products contain 0.5% lecithin or ammonium phosphatide, which is E442. These provide the right consistency so the chocolate can be moulded into bars. Sorbitan tristerate, which is E492, can delay the development of bloom where the chocolate surface takes on an unappealing dull or white appearance due to being stored at too higher temperature. And it's enough to put you off bread and chocolate just up to now. But anyway, the next one is ice cream. So emulsifiers are added during the freezing process to promote a smoother texture and prevent rapid melting after serving. They also improve freeze-thaw stability. So mono and diglycerides of fatty acids, lecithin and polysorbates, and they're known, bracketed as E432 and E436, are commonly used. All this applies to other desserts such as sorbet, milkshakes, frozen mousse and frozen yogurt. Margarine. Oh my word. Emulsifiers give margarine the required stability, texture and taste. To ensure that the water droplets are finally dispersed in the oil phase, mono and diglycerides of fatty acids and lecithin are widely used, as well as citric acid. Esters of mono and diglycerides, which is E472C, which prevent the margarine from splitting and splattering and splitting during cooking. And if that's not bad enough, because I'm worn out just by reading that, processed meat. The main components of sausages are meat proteins, fat and water, which are bound together in a stable emulsion. Emulsifiers stabilize this emulsion and distribute the fat finely throughout the product. And in low-fat meat products, food additives are responsible for making them as pleasant as their full-fat counterparts. The food industry uses mono and diglycerides of fatty acids and citric acid esters for manufacturing processed meat. Now, as I said, all that information has come from the European Food Information Council. If that's not enough to put you off eating bread, chocolate, ice cream, desserts, margarine and processed meat, I'm not sure what is. So on that note, I'm just going to summarise the health impacts of ultra-processed food. Ultra-processed food, or UPF, has been linked to 32 damaging health outcomes, according to a global study involving nearly 10 million people. So what physical conditions can ultra-processed food cause? Well, the study found that people who followed diets high in ultra-processed food were a 55% greater risk of dying young and a 21% greater risk of dying from heart disease. The likelihood of physical health problems, including type 2 diabetes, obesity and cancer, also increased along with high consumption of ultra-processed foods. So what else? What about mental health conditions? Interestingly, the study found that the risk of mental health problems tended to increase the more ultra-processed food people ate. It said that high consumption was linked to a 22% greater risk of depression and a 50% higher risk of anxiety. And the interesting thing about that is experts believe this is because ultra-processed food may cause systematic inflammation in the body and disrupt the gut microbiome, which influences depression and anxiety risk. Because you've got to remember, all these chemicals that are in ultra-processed food, they're there to make them look nice, taste nice, extend the shelf life. But actually, all those chemicals, your body, a human body, is not designed to digest those sort of chemicals. So how bad is the problem in the UK? Well, more than half of the typical British daily diet is made up of ultra-processed foods, more than any other country in Europe. Part of the problem is how addictive ultra-processed food can be, as it can evoke similar levels of dopamine in the brain to those seen with addictive substances such as nicotine and alcohol. And that's according to research from the British Medical Journal. Finally, another factor in the cost is the cost of living crisis, with 19% of people eating more ready meals and processed foods to save money, and that's according to the BBC Good Food Nation survey.
Yeah.
Great track there from Beth Blade and the Beautiful Disasters, Sin Eater. That was from 2022, and we played that because we were talking about health impacts of ultra-processed food, and also we did a bit about hidden emulsifiers in food. All bad news, really. And if you can make a small change in your diet, just try and change something every week and it'll make a massive difference. I'm sure we'll be talking lots more about that in the coming months. If you've just tuned in, of course, you're listening to the Last Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital at Being South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org, talking about science in all its different forms every Saturday 11 till 12. Next up, this week's environment updates. And just in case you've had enough of my voice, Paul will be speaking soon. First up, Doomsday Glacier. A team of scientists have spent 6 years studying the so-called Doomsday Glacier, which is a mass of Antarctic ice the size of Florida. And guess what? Their findings are not good. The glacier has been retreating for more than 80 years, and their research indicates that it is set to retreat further and faster in the coming decades. It could be completely lost by the 23rd century, which could also trigger the collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet, resulting in a disastrous sea level rise of approximately 3.3 metres.
Yes, Cumbria coal mine blocked a decade after plans for the 165 million Whitehaven coal mine in West Cumbria were first proposed. The High Court has ruled that the previous government's decision to give the scheme the go-ahead in 2022 was legally flawed. It is the first decision since the Supreme Court ruled earlier this year that future fossil fuel emissions must be considered in planning applications for new extraction projects.
Another one, wind farm opposition. Proposals to expand planned wind farm sites off the Devon and Cornwall coast could devastate the fishing industry, fishermen have warned. After the Crown Estate, which owns the seabed, published its latest map of potential development zones, which includes thousands of square miles off Land's End and the Isle of Scilly, plus an expanded zone off North Devon. Now, the Crown Estate, that's the royalty, of course, said that offshore wind has a critical role to play in supporting the UK's energy transition and that such products would create countless new opportunities within communities for skills and jobs both onshore and at sea. Watch this space because it's a really interesting concept, that.
Extreme heat. While the direct health implications of long-term extreme heat are well known, experts are now putting together a more comprehensive picture of how it might exacerbate existing conditions. A new report led by the University of Bristol found that frequent and lasting weather extremes such as heat waves could worsen the impact of kidney disease and skin cancer and also contribute to cognitive decline and conditions such as dementia. It comes as researchers in the US look into the health risks facing outdoor workers as climate change intensifies.
Indeed.
And finally,
some reasons to be cheerful. Advertising action. The Hague has become the first city to pass legislation banning fossil fuel advertising, including for aviation, cruise ships and oil companies. While other cities such as Edinburgh and Amsterdam have implemented non-binding measures that depend on agreements with advertising agencies, the ban in the Dutch city of The Hague is designed to be harder to overturn.
London oysters. Oysters may return to the Thames as part of a 10-year plan to clean up the capital's rivers. London Mayor Sadiq Khan said that he had taken inspiration from a similar project he visited on his recent trip to New York, which uses oysters to help naturally filter water and protect the city from flood damage. The New York project, which started in 2014, aims to return 1 billion oysters to the Hudson River, so watch this space.
Indeed. And finally, victory for voles. More than 100 water voles have been released into a nature reserve in Northamptonshire as part of plans to boost the species' numbers. The animals were transported to the Nene wetlands using an unlikely vessel, recycled Pringles tubes, where it is hoped they will breed and eventually spread throughout the country. 80 water voles were also released in the River Fowey in Cornwall last week. All good stuff.
Thank you.
Take Me to the River, done by Talking Heads, because we were talking about the environment, and Victory for Voles, Water Voles indeed. If you've just tuned in, of course, you're listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We'll soon be talking to RPG to see what's caught his eye in the science news this week. Before that, we're going to talk about rain.
There is a remarkable bird in India with a reputation for forecasting the rainy season each year. The red wattled lapwing is an attractive long-legged bird with a black breast and throat and a red bill, and gets its name from the red wattles in front of its eyes. It also has a distinct alarm call that sounds like it is screeching, "Did we do it?" But what makes this bird truly remarkable is its reputation for forecasting the rainy season in Rajasthan in northwest India weeks in advance, based on its nesting behaviour. This is a ground nesting bird that lays its eggs near farm fields, and many older tribal farmers use the nesting habits of a lapwing to forecast monsoon rains. When the bird makes nests on low ground, it predicts a poor rainy season, but nests made on higher ground are a sign of plenty of rain in the coming weeks. The farmers also take note of how many eggs are laid and arranged in a nest. If eggs are standing upright, that predicts heavy rainfall, but if they are horizontal, there will be only limited spells of rain, and the more eggs in a nest, the more months of rain to come. Farmers have long used the bird to decide what crops to grow, planting maize, sugarcane and other water torrent crops in fields with good drainage when the birds forecast plenty of rain. When the birds forecast low rainfall or even drought, the farmers plant hardy, more drought-tolerant crops. But how the lapwings make their rain forecast remains something of a mystery.
All very interesting, and the science debate. So, a recent scientific survey carried out over 8 years found that the birds' predictions were impressive and matched modern observations. There's a generation gap, though, with older farmers favouring the lapwing observations, but younger farmers spurning the traditional forecast and turning to modern weather forecasts instead. But the team of researchers involved point out that farmers are missing a trick if they ignore the birds, and that both scientific and traditional predictions could be blended together into a useful weather forecast. Amazing.
Been my blue-eyed son, and where have you been, my darling young one? I stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. I walked and I crawled on 6 crooked highways. Stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. It's a hard, and it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard rain's gonna fall. Oh, what did you see, my blue-eyed son? What did you see, my darling young one? I saw a newborn baby with wild wolves all around it. Saw a highway of diamonds with nobody on it. I saw a black branch with blood that kept dripping. I saw a room full of men with their hammers bleeding. I saw a white ladder all covered with water. I saw 10,000 talkers whose tongues are all broken. And it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard rain gonna fall. What did you hear, my blue-eyed son? And what did you hear, my darling young one? I heard the sound of a thunder that roared out a warning. I heard the roar of a wave that could drown the whole world. I heard 100 drummers whose hands were ablazing. I heard 10,000 whispering and nobody listening. I heard one person starve, I heard many people laughing. I heard the song of a poet who died in the gutter. And it's a hard, it's a hard,
a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard rain gonna fall. Who did you meet, my blue-eyed son? Who did you meet, my darling young one? I met a young child beside a dead pony. White man who walked a black dog. I met a young woman whose body was burning. I met a young girl, she gave me a rainbow. I met one man who was wounded in love. I met another man who was wounded in hatred. It's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart.
Beautiful track there from Bob Dylan, Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, because we're talking about the remarkable bird in India, the red wattle lapwing, which is it helps the farmers forecast the weather. Amazing stuff. If you just tuned in, of course, you're listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM, on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org. I'm sure you've all had enough of listening to me, so the good news is we've got RPG on the line. Good morning, PG.
Good morning.
Now, you've tried to tell me that the dog's eating your own work, but I know you haven't got a dog. Aha!
So
it must be the cat, then.
Oh, dear. I don't know.
So what's caught your eye in the science news this week, then?
Well, I thought I'd start off with talking about birds and a story of a lady from Harrogate called Jean Thorpe, who found a lost gannet in her garden.
Oh.
And the strange thing is that it's about 70 miles from the sea, which is the place where you usually find the gannets. I mean, one of our largest seabirds has got a wingspan up to 6 foot. It's very noticeable. It's bright white, but it's got black to its wings, and it's got a sort of yellowish sort of tinge to the back of its neck and down from there. On the 21st of September, and contacted RSPB, and they made arrangements to drive it from Harrogate to RSPB Bempton Cliffs.
Oh, yes, know it well.
Colony. And it's one of, I think, 30 colonies that are around the UK. So well done to the bird. They've put a monitoring ring on it, so they'll recognise it if it turns up again. But it's a very unusual for them to be found so far inland. So, good.
I did read an article. The reason they're coming further inland is because the food sources and the where they nest is disappearing.
It's for a lot of the gulls. But I think not for them. They do sort of high-speed dives for fish out by the coast. That's why they're sort of cliff-dwelling. So it is quite an unusual thing for them to turn up so far inland.
Yeah, wow.
Whereas gulls, I think, are becoming a lot more of a regular visitor.
There's a lot on the River Don, to be fair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, I was also looking at our TV feed and the pictures that roll through there, and there was a nice sky image, and I thought, oh, that's a nice one for a change, because usually the thing's in and around Sheffield, so probably looking a bit further afield. But that sort of made me think about a couple of things that are happening. This month, we're going to get a second mini moon, apparently.
Oh.
It's due to arrive in orbit on the 29th, so it should be appearing overhead soon. But it's called 2024PT5, and it'll looks like it'll circle around Earth until the end of November. It's only small, it's 10 metres wide, and it's made of a dull material, so it's unlikely that you're going to be able to see it with the naked eye. It was actually picked up by ATLAS, which is the Asteroid Terrestrial Impact Last Alert System.
Oh, blimey.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things out there that we've got parked, checking for incoming things in the universe. But this particular item was thought to have come from the Arjuna asteroid belt. And as I say, it's going to be too small for us to see with anything less than a very powerful telescope. But it should be hanging around for the next month or so. And also news on something that was picked up by a new satellite called EarthCare satellite. And that's looking at different things, but it's actually got a Doppler radar on board, and it's revealed the internal structure of a cloud for the first time. So it actually reveals the density of ice, snow, rain, and also can estimate the speeds that they fall to Earth from a cloud. So this particular sampled cloud was observed over the Pacific on the 13th of June. And the EarthCare orbit is above LEO, which we talked about the other week, lower Earth orbit.
Oh, you're testing us there. I'm thinking, he's all going to talk about astrology or astronomy. Yeah, no, yeah, lower Earth orbit. I like it.
Yeah, and this comet's called C/2023A3. But they shortened that to just Comet A3.
I love how they name them, because the other, that mini-moon you said was called what? C?
It's 2024PT5.
Yes, obviously it's 2024, isn't it?
That's right. So it's from when they're spotted, and then they give it
amazing
little mini-name on the end. But this comet should be coming into view in the Northern Hemisphere, and it's possibly visible on the low horizon in the eastern sky before dawn. So it's not a great thing at the early part of the month, but from about the 11th of October, after sunset, if you look in the western sky, then they're predicting it could possibly be visible to the naked eye.
Wow.
So a couple of things whipping about through the heavens, I thought it'd be interesting to talk about.
Excellent.
But, coming back down to Earth, I also picked up some information about the Festival of Words, which is off the shelf festival, and it's been running for some years now, from the 7th of October through to the 3rd of November, and it's celebrating books, words and ideas.
Oh.
So had a quick scan to see what kind of things were coming up. And we got things like a presentation called Collision, Stories about the Science from CERN. The Hadron Collider. So they're going to examine the science from CERN's past, present and potential future. But there's going to be a presentation and talk, I think, at Firth Hall, the University Firth Hall. Tickets at £10 and £8 on the 19th of October at 7:30. So that's a kind of an interesting one, I thought.
Indeed. So is it the Festival of Words? It is a Sheffield.
It is based. A Sheffield festival, yes.
Yes.
So it's very good. And I think you talked about sort of mental issues and some of the problems. So there's another presentation going to be on the 25th of October at 12:30 lunchtime. It's called 10 Times Karma.
Oh.
How to Beat Anxiety and Change Your Life.
Oh, I say.
So, it's a presentation by Dr. Kiran Schnack. And she's a professional clinical psychologist with more than 500,000 followers on TikTok. So she's going to be talking about her book. That's going to be at the Millennium Gallery.
Oh, wow.
And I think it's £9 or £7 a ticket. Not quite sure what the differential is for the tickets. But another one, somebody that I enjoy reading is thing that he does in the Yorkshire Post, but Mind Your Language, and it's a presentation by Ian McMillan, the Barnsley Bard, and Patrick Murphy, and they're exploring the language of mental health and how that's changed from the establishment of Sheffield's Middlewood Hospital in 1872 up to the current day. Which is, I thought, quite a good one. That's at Millennium Gallery. It's going to be on the 15th of October, and it's a lunchtime one again. But Ian McMillan is very funny, very witty, and very poetic, depending on which version of him you catch. And I thought that was an interesting thing. So there are some pamphlets going about in town, so do pick one up. I think also one that caught my eye was Nine Minds, which is the live Inner Lives on the Spectrum. So basically this is from a mathematician to a murder detective, a surgeon to a novelist, and how the changing world sees each of them on the mental spectrum, I think, is what it comes from.
Wow.
Daniel Tammet is an autistic savant, and he draws out the inner worlds of his subjects, tells their stories. That's, again, going to be at the Millennium Gallery, and that one's on the 11th of October. So some great stuff, I think. There's a lot of cultural stuff as well that's covered, so things like translating poetry and looking at various things. I think the rise of hip-hop, grime and rap and drill, that's Slam Bars Reloaded on the 10th of October, 6:30 in the evening at the Leadmill.
Oh, I say. So there's a real range of topics there then.
It's really very good. Now, I think there's the author of a bestseller, or there's actually somebody talking about the bestseller that's come out recently called Butter by Asako Yazuki. That's going to be at the auditorium, the University of Sheffield Students Union.
So wow.
That one's one of the early ones. People like Richard Ayoade, the comedian, is going to be here talking about his book. So I think 3rd of November, 3rd of October to the the 7th of October to the 3rd of November is the festival, and the great presentations. I'll say, just try and pick up one of these leaflets. I'm not sure if you can follow it, if you like, on offtheshelf.org.uk, and I'm sure you'll be able to pick up.
Well, I bet you can. I bet you can find that online as well.
Yes, that's what I say. I think if you go look online, it's Off the Shelf is the thing. I think one of the magazines supports it as well now, then, I think.
Does it say who founded that festival of words?
Well, I think it started with sort of...
I take it there's somebody at your trying to call you, Paul. You see, this is a beauty of live radio, isn't it?
It is.
It's
brilliant. And I think I can see from the display that it's another junk call. So.
Oh, well, yeah, so ignore it.
Yeah, I'll let my phone answering service deal with
it. Get rid of it. Brilliant.
Yeah, but I think Off the Shelf was founded by libraries, Sheffield Libraries.
Oh, was it? Oh, okay.
Way back when, I think I interviewed them quite early on in my time with Sheffield Live. So it's something that's developed. It's the University of Sheffield. It's supported by the Arts Council and Sheffield Hallam. So I think from those beginnings, I think it's become a very interesting sort of period of talks that you can go and look at lots of different subjects and sort of melancholy undercover, the Book of Abba.
Oh, interesting.
One of the presentations. So it's really interesting, I think, for a local sort of event.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the science one, the collision about the CERN and at Firth Hall, brilliant, because we've got two great universities, haven't we?
Absolutely, yeah.
And a lot of research goes on in those universities.
Yes, I mean, we cover quite a lot of what they get up to. So it's very interesting, I think. But probably, I think, one of the other things that caught my eye is tinge more serious, I think, is the looking around for a rural area in the UK to take some of our nuclear waste.
So I
did look into this some years ago, but it's basically talking about Sellafield, which is obviously the one of our foundation nuclear sites. But it's also one of the most hazardous nuclear sites in the world. So they're constantly monitoring the stockpile of radioactive waste that they've got in containers. So they're saying it's a temporary home to the vast majority of the UK's radioactive waste, as well as the world's biggest stockpile of plutonium.
Wow.
So the waste, the products of the reactors that have been with us for 70 years. But what they also say is that radioactive waste releases energy that can penetrate and damage cells in our bodies and can remain hazardous for 100,000 years. That's an explanation from Claire Corkill, Professor of Radioactive Waste Management at the University of Bristol. But, sadly, Sellafield's filling up. So experts say we've got no choice but to find somewhere new to keep the nuclear material safe. So it says that basically nuclear power comes from splitting the uranium radioactive atoms, and that reaction produces heat, which is then used to generate electricity. But creates radioactive waste, which is cooled and stored, but still contains the sort of radioactive material. So the article that's on the BBC website says that inside Sellafield's fuel handling plant, you can watch from behind a metre-thick lead-lined glass as operators remotely control robotic arms. So a little bit like that wonderful game that you used to get by the seaside where you put money and steer the little crane to try and pick up
and never get anything. Or get something you don't want.
But it's a bit better controlled, I hope. So,
But it's an interesting story, though, for lots of reasons. Number one, nobody wants to be living near that rural area that they're going to choose to have another store, are they?
They're going to take a straw poll around places to say whether they want to put their hands in the air to look at it. But just to give it some scale, at the moment, Sellafield runs 24 hours a day with 11,000 staff. It's costing more than £2 billion a year to keep that site going. It's got over 1,000 buildings, and it's connected by 25 miles of road. Yeah, so it's a massive undertaking, and say it's really the operating the site first started in the 70s, so it's been around for quite a while. And the Guardian recently revealed that although its systems have been hacked, there was no evidence that any vulnerabilities have been exploited by hackers. But as this problem sort of grows, and it's sort of materials that started in the Cold War race for bombs and things in the nuclear age. So There's a leaking storage silo built in the 1960s. This is now leaking again slightly, although it's previously been leaking. So it's not without dangers. And the current plan for the solution is to bury the waste deep underground. So basically what Professor Corkill says is that we need to isolate it from future populations and even civilizations. That's the kind of timescale that you're looking at. And that radioactive material is made safe by essentially it's baked into, so it's turned into a solid glass or ceramic-like material that's just like the rocks that the uranium originally came from. So it's stabilized that way before it's stored on site. And the plan is that it'll go into solid waste into a Russian doll-like series of barriers. So the glass is encased in steel, then shielded by concrete, and then buried beneath the earth on barriers of the layers of rock that are there. So 6 years ago, communities in England and Wales were asked to come forward if they were willing to consider having disposal facility near their town or village. Potential sites will need ideal geology, enough solid rock to create the permanent barrier, but they also need something else, which is, might be more difficult. That's a willing community.
Well, I was going to say, did anybody come forward? Because it's not sort of thing you offer up, is it? But it's an interesting one, because earlier in the show we were talking about there's a massive opposition to wind farms that the Crown Estate's planning on putting it, particularly in the south, you know, Devon, Cornwall, and that area. But it's a fine balance, because if we're moving away from fossil fuels, we don't want to be dependent on fuel from other places, then where's our energy going to come from? So wind farms, people aren't happy about. Nuclear power, people aren't happy about. So what's the answer then?
Well, I think, again, technology moving forward, one of the other things I was looking at this week is vertical turbines. Vertical wind turbines. I think BMW are going to install and test run one. But what it does, it creates a vortex inside the generator. So it's just a sort of a framework cage around the movement that generates the electricity. And they said it's actually more bird friendly. So At the moment, there's a bit of collateral damage of birds and wildlife hitting the rotating blades. So I think they are looking at that. There's some sort of steps forward, I think, in solar power generation. And I think that what it's crying out for is the applications to be controlled in some way. And I think at the moment it's still sort of free market to try and come up with something that people will invest in. So, I mean, I think we've talked about ground source heat pumps in the past, and it's still a struggle to make the capital investment needed for something that's driven by ground source heat pumps. If they can get things into scale, so again, things like the wind turbines, the vertical turbines, if they can get them up to scale, then the price starts to come down. And I think, again, one of the things that's causing problems in the UK is, for the infrastructure, we need to carry the stuff to where it's needed, electricity.
Yeah.
And the cheapest way that they see of doing it is still pylons. So there's talk of releasing a lot of the controls on installing pylons on across the landscape.
Yeah.
So all of these things come at a cost. And I think that on this thing that Sellafield, they did put out an offer. There would be sort of financial incentives that were going to people who wanted to volunteer to take it up. There was a site in Lincolnshire, one up in Cumbria, which again causes a lot of upset with people who take different opinions.
Indeed. And on that note, Paul, I'm afraid we're going to have to let you go. We've got the film showing, raring to go. Have you got some good stuff, folks, this week?
Not bad.
Oh, not bad. Are you happy? Thanks a lot, Paul. I know. Bye-bye, Paul. Bye.
Bye. Yeah. Bye, guys. Bye.
Surrounding, I can't seem to think.